From Sacramento, the Bishop's Radio Hour with Bob Dunning, focusing on today's issues in the context of gospel values. Now, here's Bob Dunning on Relevant Radio.
That's me. Welcome to you on this beautiful day the Lord has made as we move on into the summer, heading to July and et cetera. Stay safe out there. Seems as if the coronavirus is making a comeback, which we're not too happy about, but stay safe and be responsible, and we'll all be better for it. The Lord's in charge. Remember that. James Cavanaugh joins us now for our Liturgy Matters, Lessons on the Liturgy. James, good morning.
Good morning. Good to be with you again.
Good to be with you, James. So much happening out there in our world. But the big thing is we're back into ordinary time.
That's right. Yeah. Back into ordinary time. And we're getting into the summer season. And you know, it's kind of ironic because summertime is customarily a time when attendance sort of lags because people are traveling or on vacation or doing other kinds of things like that. And but now because of the coronavirus, and of course, like you mentioned, an uptick in cases now, that there's going to be even fewer people in attendance, unfortunately.
Yeah, you know, we talked to Bishop Soto the other day, and he said it has not been overwhelming. He was as a bishop, you want your churches to be full, but at the same time, he wants everybody following all the rules, which is limited attendance, and feels that that's the best course right now, and in cooperation with state and county, city guidelines, et cetera. We got 20 different counties here in the Diocese of Sacramento to deal with. And just taking it very gradually and assuring everybody if they're not comfortable coming back, don't. And if you're over a certain age, you probably shouldn't be coming back anyway.
Right.
At least for the time being, obviously.
Sure, yeah. So it's been a tough time, I think, for a lot of people. You know, when it comes to religious matters, it's important to keep up a habit of practicing our faith.
Right.
And just like anything in life, you know, when you get out of the habit, eventually it has a bad effect.
I can tell you, I'm one of those people that a few years ago started swimming most days. I don't have a swimming pool, but you know, going to a place where I can swim some laps and just to try to stay in shape. And boom, one day, they said, we're closing the pool, you know, and I thought, okay, well, you know, I guess I'll go a couple of weeks without swimming. Well, it was over three months. I got back in that pool and almost drowned, you know. It was like, what, these parts of my body aren't working, you know. Like you say, you get into a habit, you know.
That's right. And, you know, habitual things have a positive effect because, well, number one, when you just do something by habit, you don't have to really think about it that much. I mean, that's the danger and the downside, of course, is that you don't think about it. But the positive upside of it is that you don't have to think about it. It just happens automatically, like you say, like when it comes to swimming or other kinds of exercise. When we get in the habit of doing it and we just don't think about it, it becomes just a natural part of our lives. Well, the same thing with religious practices. You know, and that's really what the virtue of religion entails, is simply the habitual practice of giving honor and glory to God. And the liturgy, which is, of course, what this whole segment is all about, the liturgy provides a structure and a format so that we can maintain that connection, which is really, you know, that's what the word religion means. It means connection, religio. Legio comes from the Latin, from which we get the same word ligament, which is a connective tissue. And so to be religio is to be reconnected. So religion is all about the practice of getting reconnected with God on a regular basis. And, you know, in recent months with the coronavirus and people's habits of attending Mass being upset or interrupted, it's made that practice of religion or being reconnected with God on a regular basis much more difficult. A lot of us, I know myself especially, have had to turn to other sorts of devotional mm-hmm. practices that I can do on my own that don't rely as much on the public worship of the Mass, but ways in which we can stay connected. And of course, that's one of the beautiful things about Catholicism, is that we have this enormous reservoir of devotional practices that can appeal to, you know, every different kind of individual. And so we have a lot of resources at our disposal, but, you know, they're never quite this, they're really meant to supplement our public worship of God at Mass, not replace it. So
sure, and yet at the end of Mass, we're told to go forth, you know, and spread the good word, do good works, et cetera, you know, spread the good news. So that's as we're leaving Mass. So even as we were unable to go to Mass, we were still encouraged and told to go out in the world and do good things.
Yeah, that's true. There's still that imperative to shed the light of Christ to the right. world around us. But here's an important thing to realize, and this is why liturgy and this segment is so important, is that all of the Church's charitable works, corporal works of mercy or spiritual works of mercy, or any kind of apostolate or other activity, you know, that's directed towards the betterment of the world, really flows from the Eucharist and leads back to it. Mm-hmm. In other words, when we're engaged in an apostolate or a work of mercy and so forth, it's really not us that's doing the work. It's really Jesus Christ that's doing the work with us as his instruments, his, you know, Christ has no body now on earth but yours, no hands, no feet on earth but yours, etc. And so it's really Christ working in and through us, doing these charitable works in the world, which has been impaired by our inability to attend Mass the way we normally would, which is not to say, you know, we can't continue to do good works and be engaged in the world and stuff like that, but it just means that there's something missing, you know, from the equation, and that's namely the presence of Christ in our bodies, which is given to us through the sacraments.
Yeah, and, you know, I mean, given that this was instituted the night before he died, darn good reason. It wasn't one of many things. It was the thing.
Yeah.
Take this, right. Eat this, take this, drink it. You know, it was very clear, very direct, very profound, and almost in some way superseded everything else, or was at a higher level. I don't know quite how to put it. Everything Jesus said, of course, is important. But this one is the source and summit.
Yeah, well, you know, when he broke bread and at that first Eucharist at that Passover, you know, he was, as he says in the words of institution, he was establishing a new covenant. Mm-hmm. He was establishing the Church as his kingdom, the visible kingdom on earth. You know, the kingdom of heaven is, of course, a spiritual reality. The Church is that spiritual reality made visible on earth. That's why the Second Vatican Council described the Church as like a sacrament. You know, remembering that a sacrament is a visible sign instituted by Christ to give grace. And that's exactly what the Church is, a visible sign instituted by Christ through which his grace flows into the world. And so when the Church, you know, especially at her core, which is the Mass, when that enterprise is interrupted or impaired in any way, then it impairs the Church's ability to engage the world, to be a light to the nations. But more importantly, it impairs Christ's work in the world. That's the main thing. And so hopefully, you know, this crisis will pass eventually, and the church will be able to once again be the church and really, you know, make a difference in the world.
Yeah, we've been waiting for this crisis to pass. It's relentless, and it seemed as if we were over the hump, and for whatever reason, and then there was a lot of talk, of course, that it would die down in the summer, and that seemingly hasn't happened. In fact, the three states that you think of as hot weather in the summer, California, Arizona, Texas, and Florida, that's four states, they have a serious spike in cases right now. So we're still struggling with it.
I guess that means we better move to Alaska or something.
Alaska's very low. Very low. Of course they did tell the tourists to please stay home. So you know, and Hawaii is very low, and Hawaii had the same kind of thing. You know, both and it shows you, you know, both are very isolated, and if you restrict air travel and you're that isolated, well, nobody's going to say, well, let's drive over to Alaska for the afternoon. You know, it isn't going to happen.
It's a
strange one. But as I keep telling our kids, who sometimes get a little bit restless, God's in charge. He knows what's going on.
Yeah, just got to trust in God.
Yep.
Well, I'd like to, you know, turn our attention to the readings for this coming Sunday.
Yeah.
Which is the 13th Sunday. In ordinary time, it's kind of a twofold commemoration this Sunday. For most of the church, it's simply the 13th Sunday of ordinary time. But for our diocese, the parishes are asked to commemorate the anniversary of the dedication of the cathedral, which always happens at the end of June, the last Sunday in June. It's always near the feast of Corpus Christi, which was the celebration last Sunday. And, or was it the Sunday before? But just recently. So the cathedral was originally founded, I believe it was June 30th, if I'm not mistaken. Uh-huh. Way back in 1900 or very, you know, over 100 years ago. And the whole city in Sacramento turned out there. You can see some great pictures that were taken at the time, these great black and whites.
Yeah, I think it's kind of the baptism into being a real big, important city is when you had a Catholic cathedral.
Oh, yeah, interesting. Well, that's reflected in these old photos because you just, in the plaza outside the cathedral, you just see, you know, thousands of people gathered for this event. So, you know, people who weren't even Catholic saw the dedication of the cathedral as being an important event, not just for Catholics, but for the whole city of Sacramento.
Exactly. And it remains so today. Major tourist attraction, and not just for tourists, but for Sacramentans, you know, it's a landmark. It's a beacon of hope. It stands for all good things. You know, it's very important, and it's close enough to keep an eye on the legislature at the Capitol.
That's right. Got to keep those legislators in line. So this Sunday, the parishes are asked to include in the readings for the Sunday readings for the anniversary of the dedication of the church. Mm. And I can't really comment on all the readings because there's several options available. But the gist is the same of all of them. They all deal with the dedication of a church and the anniversary of the dedication of a church. And then all of the propers, that is the prayers, the collects, the preface to the Eucharist, all those things all are supposed to reflect the anniversary of the dedication of a church. So it's really the one time in the whole year when the entire diocese, in a sense, kind of rallies around the mother church, the cathedral, and remembers her birthday, her anniversary, when she was dedicated. And it's a wonderful occasion of celebration for the cathedral, of course, but it's also a wonderful opportunity for the diocese, as far-flung as it is, to be united around this one church.
Yeah, it's just remarkable to think it's still standing in an area that has had a few earthquakes, a few floods, there it is. And it is, and it's spectacular. You know, people can argue about buildings and architecture and everything else. This one is just classically gorgeous, I think, for all ages.
Yeah, for those of your listeners that may not know, the architectural style of the cathedral was patterned after a church in Paris. I believe it was Holy Trinity Church in Paris.
Uh-huh.
Bishop Minogue, who was the first bishop of Sacramento, had studied in Paris as a seminarian. And while he was there, of course, he had the opportunity to visit, you know, many important sites and churches throughout the city of Paris. And one in particular, Holy Trinity Church, particularly captivated him. And so the cathedral here in Sacramento was modeled after that church in Paris, France. And if you look at the facade of the cathedral, the idea of the Holy Trinity is apparent because you have those three towers rising above the facade, you know, the main central tower in the middle, which is the tallest, and then you have the two side towers, which are also quite tall. But that threefold, and then there's three portals by which to enter the church. And so the threefold nature of the Trinity is reflected in the architecture of the cathedral itself.
Wow, and correct me if I'm wrong, but I believe Bishop Minogue was an Irishman.
He was, yeah. He was, as many of the first generation of Catholic priests in this area, they were all predominantly Irish. And,
right.
Bishop Minogue was.
And, of course, the Sisters of Mercy who came over, and yeah.
Yeah.
And much prior to, I think the Sisters of Mercy came in 1857, something like that. Much earlier. So did the cathedral, I mean, obviously there were Catholics in the city who were going to Mass. Did the cathedral replace a church on that site that was not
on that site, but nearby?
Mm-hmm.
I'm not exactly sure of the location, but, the church, the cathedral is bordered by K on the south side.
Right.
And what is it, L on the north side?
I think it's actually J.
J on the north side,
yeah.
K on the south side, J on the north side.
Because it kind of takes up two blocks there. It blocks, I think it blocks L.
And then 11th Street runs in front of the cathedral, and then 12th Street is on the east side.
East side, yeah.
And so there was originally, there was a Catholic church in that area, not on that exact site, but just within a few blocks, I think maybe on J Street or perhaps L Street, a little closer to the river, maybe more around 10th or 9th, somewhere down in that neighborhood. And it was called the Immaculate Conception. That was the original Catholic church. And then it was replaced by the cathedral.
Very interesting.
Yeah.
So it was the original. It was the first and only for a while, Immaculate Conception.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. That was the first Catholic church in downtown Sacramento. Hmm. I don't know when it was built, but of course it was replaced then by the cathedral. And I think the cathedral was dedicated in want to say 1910, but I'm not positive of the exact year.
It might even
but
be
it was over 100 years ago.
Yeah, and...
Yeah, and if your listeners have... I know some of your listeners live far away from Sacramento, but if you ever have a chance to visit Sacramento or in the area, it's really worth your while to visit the cathedral. You know, make it a pilgrimage, you know, more than just like a sightseeing tour, but make it an actual pilgrimage. Spend some time in the Blessed Sacrament Chapel, which is behind the high altar, and you know, it's just it's very conducive to prayer. And then in other parts of the cathedral, there's lots of beautiful artwork. There's a small side chapel depicting important saints of the Americas. And on the other side, a picture showing the figure of Christ. And then the stained glass windows depicting the mysteries of the rosary. And so there's so much to see. But the one thing I would really encourage any of your listeners to do if they visit the cathedral is to spend some time studying the dome. And the cathedral has a little booklet in the narthex that explains all of the medallions in the dome. Bring your Bible and study the dome, because what is depicted on the inside of the dome are all of these medallions that illustrate elements of the Blessed Sacrament. That's where the word, you know, the name of the city comes from. It's where the name of the river comes from. It's where the name of the chapel or the cathedral comes from, the Blessed Sacrament. And so inside the dome are all of these depictions from the Old Testament first that prefigure the Eucharist, and then their New Testament fulfillment right below them. But it just gives you the scripture reference. So you have to have your Bible with you so you can actually look up, you know, the passages, for example, from Isaiah and see its fulfillment in one of the Gospels or Paul's letters. And you could spend, you know, it'd be a great thing to do to bring like a confirmation class to the cathedral and spend an hour and deciphering all of those different depictions of how the Blessed Sacrament, the Eucharist, is prefigured in the Old Testament and then fulfilled in the New Testament. And it's all illustrated right there in the dome of the cathedral.
Wow. Yeah, I'm looking at the directory of the Diocese of Sacramento with the history page, and the cathedral, you better be sitting down, 1889.
Is that when it was dedicated?
Yeah.
Oh, wow.
And
older than I thought.
The new diocese was created in 1886. And then with Bishop Minogue, because it used to be the Grass Valley Diocese. Of course.
Yeah, originally the diocese in Center used to be up in in Grass Valley, and I think it was in Marysville.
In Marysville, yes, it was in Marysville prior, and then Grass Valley, and then we eventually became the Diocese of Sacramento. Was carved out of this, according I'm reading this, was created out of the old Grass Valley Diocese, to which were added 10 counties in Northern California and 8 in Nevada.
Oh yeah,
we've always had sort of a kinship with Nevada.
Yeah. Yeah, well, reading the life of Bishop Minogue is very, very interesting. You know, before he went to the seminary, he was a minor.
Yes, I think in Nevada, correct?
Yeah, in Virginia City. And that's where he, you know, a lot of the guys that he worked with up there, you know, as a young man, eventually, you know, struck it rich in the silver mines
right.
of Virginia City. And it was a lot of their money that built the cathedral.
That's so interesting. I think I knew that story. And speaking of beautiful churches, there's a beautiful church in Virginia City.
Yes, there is. I forget the name of it, but it's worth a visit as well.
Yeah, and you think of, you know, Virginia City is known as a ghost town, but boy, that that church is beautiful and vibrant.
Wow.
Yeah. Yeah, so I can't remember the name. I think it has the Blessed Mother's name in it, but I can't remember it right now.
I'm sure somebody will look it up
Gabe,
quickly enough.
The church in Virginia City. Gabe's going to get it for us.
Okay, good. Yeah, so this Sunday is very important, so hopefully your parishes will remember the cathedral. At the very least, you know, remember the cathedral in the prayers of the faithful, the intercession. You know, pray for the rector there, Father O'Reilly, and all the people that work there at the cathedral. They do a wonderful ministry. And, of course, the cathedral is the seat of the bishop. That's why it's called the cathedral. Cathedra is just a fancy name for seat or chair, and it's the chair of the bishop. So it's the bishop's official church, and that's why it's the cathedral.
Before everybody reaches for the phone to call us, I was right about that it had something to do with the Blessed Mother, but that's a pretty easy guess when you're Catholic. St. Mary of the Mountains.
There you go.
Yeah.
Beautiful.
Thanks, Gabe.
Yeah.
I don't think he even had to look it up. He just knew it off the top of his head.
Yeah. Yeah, so like I said, there are special readings for the dedication, the anniversary of the dedication of a church that churches are asked to. But for the 13th Sunday in Ordinary Time, which is the readings that many of your listeners may be hearing, I just wanted to say a few words about them, the readings for this Sunday, apart from the anniversary of the dedication of the cathedral, because I think there's some really interesting little details in there. The first reading is from 2 Kings, and it's around the person of Elisha, or some people pronounce it Elisha, E-L-I-S-H-A.
Mm-hmm.
And as you may know, Elisha was the disciple and protege of Elijah. So their names sound very similar, Elijah, Elisha, or Elijah and Elisha. So that prompted me to do a little research about what their names mean, because, of course, names in the Bible are very significant. And because their names are so close, I wondered, well, what do their names mean? Well, the first part of their name, El, means God.
Mm.
And so Elijah, comes from a compounding of two words, the word for God, El, and the proper name of God in Hebrew, which, strictly speaking, isn't to be pronounced, but some pronounce it as Yahweh,
mm-hmm.
which has usually been transliterated in the scriptures as the Lord.
Mm-hmm.
Whenever you see the word the Lord, L-O-R-D, all in all caps, it's referring to the proper name of God, which is not pronounceable. But what some pronounce as Yahweh, it's when God disclosed his identity to Moses at Mount Sinai in the burning bush, when he said, I am that I am. There's various ways of even in understanding that. But I think the best way of understanding it is given to us by a verse that comes towards the end of chapter 3 in Exodus, when Moses complains that, you know, who is he to go to Pharaoh and, you know, demand that the people be set free? And God reassures him, saying, I will be with you.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, don't be afraid, I am with you. And I think that's what that name, when he first reveals himself to God as I am, is the notion that I am the God who is. I am the God who is with you. I am with you. It's the exact words that Jesus spoke to the disciples at the end of Matthew's Gospel, the very last verse of Matthew's Gospel, when he said, and I will be with you always to the end of the age. So that idea of God's presence, both is presence locally, but presence in time. In other words, God is not just an abstraction distant from us spatially or distant from us temporally, but God is a God who is present with us here and now. And that's what Elijah really means. It means God, the Lord, is with us. And then the name Elisha or Elisha means El, or God, but then the suffix of that Isha means salvation. So his name means God is my salvation.
Interesting.
And that also sort of points towards Jesus, Jesus Christ, because the name Jesus, or Yeshua, you can hear sort of a similar sound between Elisha and Yeshua. They both mean somewhat the same thing. The name Jesus means Savior.
Mm-hmm. When I first saw that name, Elisha, I just assumed it was female.
Yeah, when I tried, when I went to look up the meaning of the name, of course, poor Google, you know, they're they're not very scripturally literate. So the Google thought I was saying Elisha.
Yeah, Elisha, yeah.
Yeah, I tried to type it in, make it clear.
Yeah.
So so those names are very, very important. Elijah, meaning, you know, God is the Lord, or the Lord is God. And it reminds you of the great, what's called the Shema in Israel from Deuteronomy chapter 6, where Moses teaches this is like a profession of faith. The Lord our God is one. You shall love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul, and all your mind. But that idea of the Lord God, the Lord is one. In other words, there's only one Lord and God. And that's why we call, you know, Judaism and Christianity and Islam, for that matter, monotheistic religions, because we believe that there is simply and only one God. And so the name Elijah means the Lord, Yahweh, is God. There is no other. It's also interesting. You get into one of these names, and all of a sudden an entire universe of meaning is open in terms of like what his mission was, Elijah's mission, and that's really important, and especially important for us today as we live in a, you know, increasingly secular world, because Elijah was originally from the southern kingdom of Judah. This was after the rebellion of the northern kingdom, and the two split apart. And so Elijah was sent by God to the northern kingdom to proclaim to them the one true God, because they had departed from the one true God and began to set up shrines and altars to the local gods. And so his very name, Elijah, really connotes his mission, which was to preach and teach that there is, that God is the one and only Lord. And so Elijah's mission was to try to bring back the people of the northern kingdom, which were, you know, they're part of the people of Israel, and try to bring them back into that right relationship with God. And what's interesting about the reading for this Sunday from 2 Kings chapter 4 is it's a story about a couple that received the prophet Elisha into their home and gave him a place of rest during his ministry, much like the way that Mary and Martha gave hospitality to Jesus during his ministry. It was a place that he could go, a kind of safe haven where he could rest and relax and be shown hospitality. And that's what this couple does for Elisha, as they show him hospitality. And he goes, it tells us that he goes to this town, and the town's name is Shunem. And that means place of rest. So Shunem was a place of rest for the prophet Elisha.
Does that town still exist?
Well, I'm sure it does, but I don't know what the modern name of it would be.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
And that's Shunem.
Right, Shunem.
M is in Mary.
Yeah. And so, the fact that he had a place where he could rest and the place where he was given hospitality is indicates to us something more than just this couple were hospitable. That's sort of the obvious meaning of it. But more importantly, what it indicates is that even though the northern kingdom had separated from the southern kingdom and Jerusalem and began to worship in like an official way, but the leaders and the government officials and the religious leaders that developed in that area began to worship other gods and other shrines at other shrines and other deities, but there was still a remnant in that area, like this couple, who recognized the prophet of God, Elisha, and therefore recognized the one true God, the Lord, who is only worshipped in Jerusalem. And there's a similar story with Elijah, with the poor widow who had the son. And I'm sure many of your listeners will remember the story, how Elijah arrives in the town and there's a widow gathering sticks, and he asks her to give him something to eat, and she says, well, I don't have anything but a little jar of flour and a little bit of oil, and that's it. And once that's gone, you know, we don't have any more food. And Elijah promises her that, you know, the jar of flour will not be emptied and the cruse of oil will not be spent. Hmm. And so in a miraculous way, the flour and the oil are replenished, and she and her son don't die. But there again, she gives hospitality to Elijah in a very similar way to the way this couple in Shunem gives hospitality to Elisha. And both of those stories are meant to show that even when, and this is the moral of the story for us, is that even when the surrounding culture turns its back on God, there are still a few, a remnant, that remain faithful to God and remain stout-hearted believers. Hmm. And that's kind of the situation we find ourselves in this day, as society becomes, at the very least, you know, indifferent to the things of God, and in some instances even become hostile to the things of God, is that God is looking for that remnant, you and me, to be faithful to him no matter what. And, you know, sometimes it's very difficult when Christianity is unpopular or even mocked and ridiculed, but that's our challenge for us today.
Indeed, indeed. So this couple, we don't know their names.
No. It just says a husband and wife in Shunem. It does indicate that they were well off, however. I don't know what the significance of that is exactly, but it just says, the beginning of the reading says, one day Elisha went on to Shunem, where a wealthy woman lived who urged him to eat some food. So whenever he passed that way, and she said to her husband, behold, I perceive that this is a holy man of God who is continually passing our way. Let us make a small roof chamber with walls and put there for him a bed, a table, or a chair, and a lamp, so that whenever he comes to us, he can go there. Mm-hmm. And so they don't give us her name, but they do tell us that she and her husband were people of means. They were people of wealth, but they devoted their wealth to serving God by taking care of his prophet.
The original Airbnb.
I had not thought of that, but you're right. Yeah, that's very, very, very true. The Shunem. Well, if I were to have an Airbnb.
Some B&B somewhere is going to say, oh, we're in the Bible.
I'm
in the Bible.
I'm going to call it the House of Shunem.
So he would stay there.
Yeah. And you know that word, too, Shunem, which means rest, also has greater significance than just its most obvious sense, and that is just a place for him to rest and refresh and eat and take a bath and all the rest of it. But that whole idea of rest connotes a covenant relationship. You may remember from the opening chapter of Genesis, it concludes with God hallowing the seventh day, the Sabbath, when it says that God rested from all his labors and sanctified a day of rest for all his creatures. And then later in one of the Psalms, Psalm 95, which is recited each morning in the Liturgy of the Hours, talks about entering into God's rest. Mm-hmm. And so that whole idea of entering into God's rest is a way of entering into the Sabbath. The Sabbath, that's why we call it the Sabbath, a day of rest, because it's meant to be a time in which we abstain from worldly activities in order to renew our covenant relationship with God. That's why the seventh day is hallowed and why we call it a holy day of obligation, not just because, you know, it's a rule, you know, that the church made up just to make Catholics obedient. But it really is a way to remind us that that God himself has set apart one day of the week, the seventh day, the Sabbath, a day of rest, to refrain from all worldly activities so that we can devote ourselves to the things of God and be reminded that our ultimate destiny is not in this world, but in heaven. And so we're called each Sabbath to enter into God's rest. So that name Shunem has great significance beyond just a place for Elisha to put up his feet and have a cold one.
So explain the seventh day Sabbath. Sabado, Saturday. Explain that.
Well, you know, in the days
now, obviously
of
creation, observe on Sunday.
All the days of the week, are derived there from the first chapter of Genesis. And at the end of Genesis, chapter 1, it's after the... I'll just read it directly here. After the creation of all things, after God had done his work, it says, thus the heavens and the earth were finished, and all the hosts of them. And on the seventh day, God finished his work which he had done, and he rested on the seventh day from all his work which he had done. So God blessed the seventh day and hallowed it, because God rested from all his work which he had done in creation. And then later on in the Ten Commandments, in which the Sabbath day is to be kept holy, right. Moses explains in there is the reason that the Sabbath day is holy is precisely because God himself had hallowed it, mm-hmm. and set it apart and sanctified it as a day of rest. Now, your question, I think, is, well, why do we go to Mass on Sunday if
right.
Saturday is the Sabbath? Well, here's the reason. Saturday is still the Sabbath, but Christ transformed the Sabbath, making it a day in which he rested in the tomb.
Mm-hmm.
From his work
right.
on the cross in preparation for a brand new creation on the next day.
And rose on a Sunday.
Rose on a Sunday. Or we might say on the first day of the week, but also the eighth day of the week.
Mm-hmm.
So Jesus rests from all his labors. He dies and is laid in the tomb, and then on the eighth day, or the first day of the week, however you want to look at it, he rises from the dead as a new creation. And that's the whole significance of Sunday for us as Catholics. And that's why for Catholics, Sunday is the day in which we commemorate the resurrection of Jesus and the new creation. And it becomes then for us, quote unquote, the Sabbath, in terms of the day in which we set apart to honor God. But Saturday, Sabado, is still the Sabbath in the literal sense. So the way I like to think of it, is how you reconcile this is to think of these two things not as being in opposition to one another, but as actually complementing each other. And just as a practical thing, it's one reason why we call it the weekend, right? Because for most people in modern times, the end of the work week is Friday.
Right.
Well, why not Saturday? Well, the answer, I think, in my opinion, is that the work week ends on Friday so that we as Christians can rest, literally, or just rest from our labors, and to prepare ourselves to celebrate the new creation on Sunday. So in a sense, Saturday and Sunday, you might say, are two sides of the same coin, or they go together. They belong together. Saturday prepares for Sunday.
Indeed.
Yeah. That's the way I like to think about it. So that's why I think it's important that when we do something on Saturday, whatever we do on Saturday, by way of recreation or relaxation, is done with a view towards Sunday, to celebrating the resurrection. So Saturday is a preparation for Sunday.
And then there's a whole group of people called Seventh-day Adventists who probably reject what you just said.
Yeah, there are some Christian groups that rely solely on the Old Testament reading that the seventh day, mainly Saturday,
right,
is the Sabbath day. And that's true. That's true for Jews, even to this day, that's their Sabbath.
Right.
But, because of Christ, Jesus Christ, and what he did, rising from the dead on Sunday, and thus inaugurating an entirely new creation, that's why Catholics and traditional Christians celebrate the resurrection of Christ on Sunday.
Very well put.
Yeah. So, and it's interesting, too, because, we're beginning the summer vacation, those lazy days of summer. You can picture yourself in a hammock or in a rocking chair on the porch, sipping a lemonade, the dog sleeping on the porch, and just those wonderful, relaxed, easy days of summer. And here we have a scriptural reading in which the prophet Elijah, even himself, had to find times in which to rest, to be replenished, and to renew his relationship with God. And so the summertime for us as Catholics, even though it's a wonderful time for rest and relaxation in the ordinary sense, a time of vacation and travel, it should also be for us a time when we can rest in the sense of renew our relationship with God again and devote ourselves to more godly pursuits. Spend more time outdoors, I think that's a really important thing, Behold God and his wonderful and beautiful creation. And, of course, here in Northern California, there's so many beautiful sights to see and places to go.
Wow.
And those things by themselves can help renew your faith. So take advantage of the beautiful outdoors that we have here.
Yeah, it's if you're looking for a little getaway, I always say, you know, I talk to my wife because we're, you know, we're sheltering in place with four teenagers who are getting a little restless, and you look at the northern counties, virtually all of them in the Diocese of Sacramento, the few on the coast and the north coast aren't, Humboldt County and Del Norte County and Sonoma County, Mendocino County, or not, they're in the Diocese of Santa Rosa, but the rest of it, you know, and you look at it, those counties are very, very low in the transmission of the virus. Very low. And a great number of them have had zero fatalities, and several of them have had only one or two or three cases. And you don't have to get very far north before that's the case. Colusa County is very low. Shasta County is very low. Siskiyou County is remarkably low. Modoc County. And there's some wonderful beauty there, whether it's Mount Shasta, Mount Lassen, those or over in on the coast in the Diocese of Santa Rosa. You know, the California Redwoods are just I can't not see the Redwoods, and I can't see the Redwoods and not think of God. I know some people say, well, that's my cathedral. It's not my cathedral, but I can't. And some of those trees are go back to the time of Christ, you know, and it's just mind-boggling. And nobody was watering them. Nobody was fertilizing them, pruning them, taking care of them. It was all done by the grace of God.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting because, well, the temple in Jerusalem, but then later on churches, particularly the classical Gothic churches of Europe and, you know, some of those designs, we talked about the cathedral being imported into the United States, they have this similarity with a redwood grove, and that is that you're compelled in both instances to look up.
Mm-hmm.
You can't go into a redwood grove and not raise your eyes to heaven.
Yep.
You know, those trees are a testament to heaven and to God and to godly things. And you're compelled to look up. It reminds me of that verse from Colossians chapter 3 where Paul says, since you have been raised with Christ, seek those things that are above, where Christ is, seated at the right hand of God. So a redwood grove compels us almost to look up and to raise our minds to higher things. And the cathedral, like the cathedral in Sacramento or some of the more classic Gothic cathedrals in Europe, do exactly the same thing. And by design, you know, those columns in many of those beautiful cathedrals were meant to remind us of those tremendous works of art that God did in creation, like a redwood tree that by its very nature points to heaven.
You know, and interestingly, you can combine both of them. In the redwoods, there is a cathedral tree. Within the trees of mystery.
Named.
Yeah, and very aptly named.
Yeah.
James,
So take this opportunity this summer, you're listening. Of course, many of your listeners are in the northern part of the diocese already, so they don't have far to go to see some of these beautiful, beautiful places that we have here in Northern California, places that can open our minds and make us think of God.
Indeed. James, always a pleasure. We're flat out of time. Just greatly appreciate all you've done for us and for this show, and we wish you well.
Well, thank you. Good to be with you.
Thanks, James. God bless. That's James Kavanaugh, and Liturgy Matters, Lessons on the Liturgy. This portion of the Bishop's Hour is brought to you by a grant from the Mercy Foundation, enriching lives in the Sacramento region through Sisters of Mercy ministries in healthcare, education, housing, and the care for the poor and elderly. For the Mercy Foundation, philanthropy is one of the most powerful expressions of compassion and love. Just as many people in our community need a hand, countless others are reaching out to them with comfort and hope. You can express your care and concern for the less fortunate with a gift to the Mercy Foundation. You can give them a call, 916-851-2700. That's 916-851-2700. And you can be confident that fully 100% of your contribution will support the Sisters of Ministry of Mercy Ministry or ministries that you choose. And what a wonderful treasure Easter's Catholic Books and Gifts has been for all of us here in the diocese as they transition into new ownership and management. They continue to offer wonderful workshops, wonderful resources for the Catholic community throughout the Diocese of Sacramento. Not only does Easter's provide a wide array of Catholic books, both current releases and longtime classics, but they also sponsor a number of valuable workshops and lectures throughout the year. They're located at 6916 Sunrise Boulevard in Citrus Heights. Give them a call, 916-338-7272. We also receive a generous underwriting support by Crumley & Associates, a private wealth advisory practice of Ameriprise Financial Services. If you have questions about retirement, Crumley & Associates can help you with their confident retirement approach that can help define a clear roadmap to get you where you want to go. You can contact them, get all the details at Crumley & Associates, 7956 California Avenue in Fair Oaks. They're at 916-638-4600. That's 916-638-4600. And we are certainly appreciative of the fine and longstanding support of the Mercy Foundation, of Easter's Catholic Books and Gifts, and of Crumley and Associates. This portion of the Bishop's Hour is brought to you by a grant from the St. Vincent de Paul Society. Drop by and shop at their thrift store, a beautiful, beautiful thrift store at 2275 Watt Avenue. Open Mondays through Saturdays from 10 to 8 and Sundays from 11 to 6. They also accept donations at the store, donations of furniture, appliances, clothing, books, everyday household items. Your donations help to fund the many projects of the St. Vincent de Paul Society throughout the Diocese of Sacramento. Do such wonderful, wonderful work, and the thrift store is one of the ways they raise the funds to help people throughout the diocese, and also many of their clients are able to access the thrift store for items that they need. You can give them a call. They will come pick it up as well, but you can give them a call. They're at 916-972-1212. And remember, again, the thrift store is open 7 days a week at 2275 Watt Avenue right here in Sacramento. Well, Bishop Soto refers to Christ the King Retreat Center as the jewel of the diocese, and indeed it is. What a beautiful oasis it is. It's located in Citrus Heights, right in the hustle and bustle of the city, and you feel like you're getting away from it all when you turn off the main road and just come into Christ the King Passionist Retreat Center. Christ the King has served Northern California and the Diocese of Sacramento for over 60 years through parish weekend retreats, individual spiritual direction, and a variety of other programs. For information on all the programs that they offer, including residential programs, give them a call. They're at 916-725-4720, or you can visit them at 6520 Van Maren Lane in Citrus Heights. And we certainly thank the St. Vincent de Paul Society and Christ the King Passionist Retreat Center for their fine and longstanding support of the Bishop's Hour.
I was sure by now, God, you would have reached down and wiped our tears away, stepped in and saved the day. But once again, I say amen, and it's still raining. But as the thunder rolls, I barely hear you whisper through the rain, I'm with you. face it falls, I'll raise my hands and praise the God who gives and takes away. And I'll praise you in this storm, and I will lift my hands, for you are who you are, no matter where I am. And every tear I've cried, you hold in your hand, you never left my side. And though my heart is torn,